relationship and the sale. Red Bite. Humor is the highest form of language mastery. If you've ever heard someone say, "Boy, that guy's just naturally funny," he's probably an extremely intelligent human being. If you ever learn a foreign language, the very last thing you learn is the nuance of humor. The hardest thing to do in any foreign language is make a joke. Humor is the most difficult of nuances to master, but when you do, you have the basis for solid intellectual rapport and solid intellectual engagement. But note well, not every prospect requires or desires humor. You can tell who they are right away. They're the ones that never laugh at anything. The best thing to do when this scenario occurs is eliminate humor from your sales presentation and pray the guy's not a price buyer. In my experience, though, he probably is. People who just want to get down to brass tacks are usually the people who just want to get down to brass prices. Red Bite. What's so funny about being professional? If your entire sales talk is professional, you're likely to lose to someone whose talk is 50% professional and 50% friendly combined with funny. Friendly and funny are 1,000 times more engaging than professional. If you doubt that, take a look at any late night TV host. Are they professional or funny? How much are they making? How much are you making? Now, I don't want to compare your sales presentation to a David Letterman monologue, but I am going to compare the way you think you have to present versus the way your prospective buyer would like to be presented to. I've incorporated sales talk with funny talk for the last 35 years, and not only has it made me a ton of sales, it's also made me a ton of friends, and it will do exactly the same for you. Red Bite. The difference between a joke and a story. Most salespeople reduce themselves to joke tellers, or should I say joke retellers, or should I say bad joke retellers. Joke telling is dangerous and usually not very funny. First of all, most jokes are demeaning to one person or another. Second of all, jokes sound contrived, almost like you're trying too hard. And worst of all, if the customer has heard the joke before, it makes you look like a complete idiot, especially at the end when you're the only one laughing. Stories, on the other hand, are genuine. They tell about experience. They can use self-effacing humor. And they're engaging. Oftentimes, when you tell a story, it makes a prospect think of a story that will engage you back. In storytelling, it's called a topper. If you can get a story of his or hers, that's also a rapport builder. Storytelling is also effective in your sales presentation when the prospect is trying to relate to your product or service. Facts and figures are forgotten. Stories are retold. Red Bite. Laughter is universal. The use of humor in sales is almost never taught. The reason is most sales training and most sales trainers aren't that funny. Now, I'm not saying if you're not funny, you're not valid, but I am saying that if I'm in a selling situation against you, and I'm funny and you're professional, or I'm funny and you're not funny, I'm going to win the sale more often. If you don't consider yourself a funny person, study humor or read about how to become more humorous. You can debate about how much humor to use. You can debate when humor is most effectively inserted. You can even debate the type of humor that should be used, but you cannot deny the power of laughter as a universal bond from human to human and from human to sales order form. Principle 9, use creativity to differentiate and dominate. In this lesson, you're going to learn where does creativity come from, you, three areas to make a difference, and fix your voicemail message now. The Red Bites include creativity is a science that you can learn, and a creative approach to ending we're satisfied with our present supplier forever. So, where does creativity come from? You, baby. That's a great idea. Did you think of that? How'd you think of that? Typical comments you might hear if you come up with a great idea. So, how did you think of it?
Well, I don't know. It just came to me.
Well, almost. There's reasons for creativity. People accuse me of being creative, among other things. So much so that I'm starting to teach others. Well, that's pretty cool, considering I'm still a student myself. How much do you study creativity? Let me give you the answer. Not enough. Seeing a great idea is one thing. Having a great idea is another. Big difference between the guy that invented the pet rock and the guy that bought one. One, the inventor, is a lot more fulfilled and wealthier than the purchaser, you. So where does creativity come from? You learn it. How important is creativity in your sales success? Very. How creative are you? Not very. Can you improve your creativity? Yes. Read a book on it, practice it. Well, in my quest to understand the roots of my personal creativity, I've questioned myself and studied my environment to come up with the elements of what drives and/or inspires my own creative process. Now, I'm not telling you that this is the be-all, end-all of the creative mind, but it's an introspective look at someone who has, on more than one occasion, been accused of being creative. And as you listen, please rate yourself on each element to see how high you are on the creative capable scale. Here's the 13.5 elements that drive and/or inspire my creative process. The first is brains. Stupid people aren't very creative. The smarter you are, the more likely it is that you will have or at least are capable of having smart, bright ideas. All you need to do is understand where ideas come from and how to create the atmosphere that make them happen. The second is attitude. Negative attitude blocks creative thought. You ever finish an argument with somebody and 5 minutes later you think of what you could have said? Of course, everyone has. The reason you didn't say it in the heat of the argument is that your creative attitude brainwave was blocked by your negative attitude brainwave. Number three is the habit of observing. Looking at things and circumstances is one thing. Seeing an idea within them is quite another. When something goes wrong or something goes right, those are both opportunities to think and see things in terms of yourself. Two-word lesson, pay attention. Number four, the habit of collecting ideas. The second you think of something that has the least amount of creativity attached to it, document it. Write it down on a napkin, your Palm Pilot, a piece of paper, your computer. Try to expand the thought as much as you can the moment you get it. One of the most amazing and frustrating elements of life is how quickly creative ideas come and go. Document. Number five, your self-belief. In order for a greater amount of ideas to flow, you must first believe that you have the capability of creating one. If you tell yourself you're creative, more creative things will happen. Don't think that saying I'm a creative person is bragging. Look at it rather as an affirmation, telling yourself that new ideas are always on the horizon and or on the tip of your tongue. Number six is a support system. Surround yourself with people who encourage you. The more you hear it'll never work, the more you'll believe it, and vice versa. You need people around you to tell you that your ideas are good. Of course, not all ideas are good. Occasionally, maybe more than occasionally, ideas will be clunkers, maybe even borderline idiotic. Just remember, at some point someone said, I think we'll be able to fly from coast to coast in 4 hours, and someone else was laughing his head off. The concept, it'll never fly, is a totally erroneous one. Number seven, the creative environment. Set your own place for creativity. Some people can operate in noise, some people can't. Fighting environment is equally as non-productive as fighting with another human being. Both will eventually get to your attitude and impede or prevent your best ideas from springing forth. You will in fact be impeded. New word. Number eight, creative mentors and associations. The best way to inspire yourself is hang around other people that are creative. Someone you know casually can be just as important in your life as a mentor. The casual acquaintance may be somebody who's spontaneous, creative, or humorous. A mentor will be someone that you can ask deeper questions of that might provide insight and not just instant. Number nine, studying creativity. Aha! The more you read, the more you will understand how others have learned and taught creativity. If you've not read the classic Michael Mihalko's book, Thinker Toys, or his new book, Cracking Creativity, or any Edward de Bono book, Six Thinking Hats, Lateral Thinking, or a compilation of his thoughts entitled Serious Creativity, I recommend you start from there and immediately progress to Dr. Seuss, the champion of creativity for both adults and children. No kid can read or digest Mihalko or De Bono, but every kid can read and reread and think about and learn from and digest The Cat in the Hat, Yertle the Turtle, Green Eggs and Ham, Porton Hears a Who, or any of the Dr. Seuss legendary classics. My library has more than 25 Dr. Seuss volumes. Okay, I've given you the titles. All you got to do is buy them and read them. Number 10, studying the history of creativity in your industry. In order for you to figure out what's going on today and project your brilliant ideas into the future, you need to have a firm grip on what happened yesterday and why. As an expert in sales, the books I find most inspirational were written somewhere between 50 and 70 years ago. There's always a new wrinkle in something old. Number 11, using creative models. Look at the concepts presented in the book Six Thinking Hats or Six Action Shoes. It's classic model in creativity where the author, Edward De Bono, uses colors of the hat or the shoe to convey a process. The easiest example of the model of creativity is a concept brought out in Thinkertoys called Scamper. Scamper is simply a new way to look at an existing idea and asking yourself questions on how to improve it. Each letter in the acronym represents a different perspective to see a creative idea from. The letters represent substitute, combine, adapt, modify, maximize, or minimize, put to other use, and reverse or rearrange. If you take any object or project and put Scamper model to use within the project, you'll come up with new and creative ideas. The object of the model is to learn the practical science so that you can see there's a way for you to learn creativity rather than simply be creative. Learn rather than be. One does not replace the other. One is simply an additional method or supplement to the other. Sometimes you do things or think about things without really knowing why. The why is never as important as the is. Number 12, risk failure. There's an old expression that says no risk, no reward. I say no risk, no nothing. All creative people take risks. It's the nature of the process. Daring to think something new or try something new. The best example of creative failure I can give you is Thomas Edison. He's also the best example of creative success. He thought, he studied, he tried, he risked, he failed thousands of times. And he succeeded, big time. Thousands of brilliant inventions and ideas came from Edison. Tens of thousands of failed ideas and inventions came from Edison. Whenever your creativity or wherever your creativity takes you, risk comes along for the ride. It's a natural part of the process. Enjoy the thrill of it, like you would a roller coaster ride. If you fail to get a hit in baseball 2 out of 3 times for 20 years, you'll go to the Hall of Fame with a .333 batting average. Number 13, seeing your creativity in action. There is nothing more fulfilling than seeing your idea put to use. No matter how small or grandiose, people tend to brag or be proud of and take ownership of their idea. You see that over there? Yeah, I thought of that. Even if it's just moving something from one end of the room to the other, or setting up a new configuration of the same equipment, or creating a slogan. There's huge pride in seeing your idea. And 13.5, the ridicule factor. Whatever your great idea is, there is always someone ready to throw cold water on it. Ignore those people. They're jealous because they have no ideas of their own. Now, for those of you who think that all the good ideas are taken, take a look at the sport of ice hockey. It's more than 150 years old. The hockey mask, the goalie mask, is only 30 years old. Wouldn't you think that somebody would have come up with it in the first 120 years? Finally, one guy, Jacques Plante, got tired of getting hit in the face with the puck. Hello. And once again, necessity became the mother of invention. And he created the first goalie mask. There are a ton of other equally obvious ideas out there, and your job is to be thinking about them. There were millions of people who knew the game of ice hockey, but only one who imagined it a better, safer way to play. I found a quote inscribed in the front of the book Thinkertoys. I've read the book several times and ordered cases of them from Michael Mihalko. In it, he had written to me, "Imagination is more important than knowledge. A quote from Albert Einstein. I rest my case. The rest is up to you. Three areas to make a difference. Number one, your opening question on a sales call. Most salespeople start out with sales puke, a bunch of information about their company and their product. Yuck. Ask a smart question immediately and they will think you're smart. For example, if you're going to go in to sell printing, you would ask something like, how much is your image worth? Or do you have a specific game plan for image this year? How about, how much does one lost hour of productivity cost your company? How much does it cost you to lose one employee? If you were paying 20% more for your, whatever you insert there, than you had to, how would you know it? The second thing to do is change your ordinary imaging and branding. Voicemail, fax cover sheet, list the ordinary things that you do and change them today. Some other areas that you might get thought process going is your telephone greeting, your business card, your card title, the way you transfer a call, the way you take a message, your promotional items, and you. Number three, use your follow-up and stay in front of power to the maximum, not just a handwritten thank you note. It's the internet and your ability to have an information page, an email, a weekly tip, something of value, testimonials, stories, newsletters. The more creative you are in the way you communicate, the more creative you will be perceived to be by the only people that matter, your customers. Fix your voicemail message now. How do you greet your customers? Let's see if this sounds familiar. I'm either on my phone or away from my desk. No kidding. That's pathetic. No, no, Jeffrey, you say, I tell people what day it is. It's Monday, and I'll be in meetings in the morning, and then I'll be in and out of the office. It's pathetic. I don't care what you're doing. I called to talk to you. Voice message is America's sales enigma. Everybody has it, and 9,999 out of 10,000 people have a pathetic message, including you. Why do I need to know that you're away from your desk? Why do I need to know that you're in a meeting? Why do I need to know what day of the week it is? Answer, I don't need to know. And more accurately, I don't want to know. What I want is to get you on the phone. That's why I called. Many companies have two voicemail systems. One where a computer answers the phone and informs me for my convenience or to serve me better, I can select from 9 options. So every time I reach your silly voicemail, I'm annoyed times 2. And then there's the added element of rudeness when I call and ask for you and the live attendant sends me directly to your voicemail without having the courtesy to tell me that you're not there. Pardon my rant, but what I've just given you is a solid reason for your customer to go to your competition where their people might be friendly and more helpful. Now let's get back to you and your stupid, pathetic voicemail message. Let me give you 7.5 ideas to spice up your voicemail so that someone might tell someone else to call you just to hear your message. You see, people who buy your stuff talk to other people who buy your stuff. And if somebody calls to hear your message, that would also be known as a lead. Leads are expensive, hard to come by. Your voicemail is a key to getting new customers and creating word-of-mouth advertising about you. Number one, a short message about value or a profit point of your product. A hint, a tip. For example, tell me one thing I can do to profit from the use of your product. Number them and change the message every week. Number two, a thoughtful quote. The internet will give you millions, but this has to be changed every day. Number three, a celebrity impersonation. Somebody who does voices or do a bad one yourself. Rodney Dangerfield. I can't get no respect. But I can get your return phone call. Number four, your kid. Hi, I'm Dave's costly accident, Jason. He's out earning my college tuition. You can help by leaving a message that includes an order. Number five, something funny in general. Say this in some weary voice. I'm just an old man and it's a big world. Number six, something funny about your product or your business. Hi, you've just reached Tom and I'm out saving the world one box at a time. Please leave a message and I'll try to find a cardboard carton to save your world. Number seven, a testimonial from a customer. Can you imagine one of your best customers saying something like, Hi, I'm Dave Smith from ABC Plumbing. Joe's over here right now taking care of our account like he has for the past 10 years. Please let him take care of yours. And 7.5, something off the wall. The reason I'm saving this for the end is that many people are uncomfortable to go off the wall, and many bosses are uncomfortable by off-the-wall messages, and sometimes the customer will not like an off-the-wall message, but off-the-wall messages will be talked about the most. Hi, I'm probably here, I'm just avoiding somebody I don't like. Leave me a message, and if I don't call you back, it's you. My message, I'm always off the wall. My present message is, hi, this is Jeffrey. I wish I could talk to you right now, but I can't. Please leave your American Express card number with that expiration date, and I'll get back to you right away. Now, this may seem somewhat crazy to you, but three people a day leave their American Express number. It's fun, it's memorable, and it's non-offensive. Make the message short, 35 words maximum. Script it, rehearse it, then record it. Change the message often. Weekly is best. Listen to the comments carefully. They will tell you how good your message is or isn't. If you claim to be different from your competition, a great place to start would be your recorded message. Here's a list of creative voicemails some of my customers use. Hi, you've reached Scott of RCM&D. I'm out finding new clients who have yet to realize that they need our services. So please leave me a message so you can be the client that I'm visiting. Hi there, it's Martin, and you've called on the greatest day of my life. Thanks so much for calling me and making my day even better. And please let me know who you are and what I can do to help you at the sound of the tone. Have a great day. I know I will. Beep. Hi, this is Ray, and I'm in Nighthawk's Genius Training Program. I'm only at the know-it-all level, but leave your question and I'll call you back with an answer. Hi, this is Randy. I wish I could talk to you, but I can't. I'm working like a madman to send my son away to trade school. Please leave an order and a message, and I'll get right back to you. You've reached the voicemail of Larry. I'm out selling title insurance right now, but please leave a message. With one daughter getting married and the other starting graduate school, you can be certain that I will get back to you as soon as I can. I plugged in my electric guitar and strum a few really bad chords, and then I come on and say, hi, this is Greg. Can't come to the phone right now because I'm out practicing my electric guitar. Leave a message. Better yet, leave an order so I can afford lessons. You've reached ABC Photography. We're not here. Now that Dave is married and he finally has a life, if you want to reach him, do his wife a favor and call his cell phone or leave a message. Here's one. My 7-year-old son is speaking. Thanks for calling Leslie. This is her son, Jacob. I need a new PlayStation game, so leave your name and number, and I'll make sure that she calls you back. If you want more information about creativity, go to Gittimer.com and enter the word scamper in the Gitbit box. Red Bite. Creativity is a science that you can learn. If I ask you on a scale of 1 to 10, how important is creativity in sales and service, you're going to answer 10. If I ask you on a scale of 1 to 10 how creative you are, that's a different and probably a much lower answer. Have you ever read a book on creativity? Probably not. It amazes me how many people have never read a book on creativity. Well, here's the good news. There's plenty of them at the bookstore. I've told you, The Best is Thinker Toys by Michael Mihalko. Buy it. Read it, study it. Red Bite. A creative approach to ending we're satisfied with our present supplier forever. I mean, you ever hear your prospect tell you, I'm satisfied with my present supplier? Sure you have. How many times? Why are you still listening to it? With a little creativity, you can eliminate it forever. Here's how. When you engage the prospect, you say, you know, Mr. Jones, I make a lot of calls to prospective new customers, and most of them tell me that they're satisfied with who they've got. Our customers are ecstatic, getting incredible value, are more productive, and reaping the profits of doing business with us. Would you rather be ecstatic and more profitable or satisfied? The customer will say, ecstatic and more profitable. Great, you say. I'm here today hoping that you were satisfied with who you got. Take away the objection before they have a chance to voice it. Principle 10, reduce their risk and you'll convert selling to buying. In this principle, you're going to learn the obvious way to sell, eliminate the risk of buying, replace risk with a powerful closing tool, risk removal, and the red bites. The biggest barrier to a sale is the unspoken risk that the prospect perceives, and if you eliminate the risk, they will buy. And finally, no risk, no balls. The obvious way to sell, eliminate the risk of buying. Eliminate risk, and prospects are more likely to buy. What a concept. How much simpler can selling get? In order to harness the power of this strategy, ask yourself these five questions as they relate to your product or sale. Number one, what is the definition of risk? Number two, what's the cause of risk? Number three, how much risk am I asking my prospects to take when they make a purchase? Number four, how do I uncover risk factors? Number five, how is risk taken away, removed, or eliminated? A risk of purchase is some mental or physical barrier, real or imagined, that causes a person to hesitate or rethink ownership. As a salesperson, your job is to identify the risk and then eliminate it. Interestingly, risk is harder to identify than it is to eliminate. What is risk to some people is a walk in the park to others. What may seem ordinary or of no consequence to the salesperson is a huge risk to the prospect. What may be just a few thousand dollars to someone may be, oh my gosh, $3,000 to others. What are the most common elements of the risk of purchase? Well, here's several to think about in the way they may go through the mind of your prospect. Financial misjudgment. Worried about the value of dollars spent, the risk of overpay or not getting my money's worth. Financial risk. Is it affordable? Am I spending too much? Is it a budget violation or will I lack the ability to pay? I don't really need it. What if I get it and never use it? Do I really need this? Am I risking regret? I may be able to get the same thing cheaper someplace else. I don't want to get it right now. I want to shop around. I may be risking overpayment. Not what I pictured in my mind. This isn't really what I want. I'm risking getting something I don't really want. It's not what I perceived or thought at first. This isn't how I pictured it. This is also known as second-guessing judgment. I'm risking getting the wrong thing. Quality of product misjudgment, the risk of poor performance. I'm risking this thing falling apart. Service after the sale won't be there. Will it be what I expect? Will it be there when I need it? Do I want to risk poor service? Product won't perform as I expected. The function or the utilization of the product is in doubt. I'm risking poor performance. Something better exists. The risk that there might be a better mousetrap if I just look around a bit longer. Obsolete as soon as I get it. The risk that a new model will come out the day I make my purchase. Computers do this all the time. Looking foolish. The risk of making a bad or a dumb choice in your own mind or in the minds of others. The risk of ridicule. The salesman's lying. The risk of non-delivery or overstated, not what he claims it to be, promises. I don't trust this guy. Will someone be mad at me? Will I get in trouble? Obvious thought patterns of buyers having trouble making a decision on their own. Do I want to risk getting yelled at for this purchase? Risk is actually a lack of confidence, trust, and believability, either in the product, the service, the company, the salesperson, or in oneself. The absence of these elements causes doubt and rethinking of the purchase. Reality. If there's a need, if there's an ability to buy, if there's not a hidden agenda like an existing relationship, friend in the business, not the real decision maker, then the person who hesitates is doing so for one of the following reasons. One, cold feet. Two, their gut says no. Three, fear of the unknown. Four, not enough information. And 4.5, lack of confidence or trust in the salesperson, the company, or the product. In short, the potential risk of purchase outweighs the reward of ownership. Here's what to do. Here's a success strategy. Find out their tolerance for taking a risk. Some people take more risks than others. Ask about gambling. Ask about entrepreneurial risks taken before. Ask about previous purchases. Measure their tolerance and their previous experience. In other words, look for causes. Here's a success strategy. Know your risks of purchase. There's less than 10. List them and have risk-removing answers for them. List what your prospect has to lose if they buy. List the corresponding or canceling gains if they buy. Ask your prospect to weigh the total package, not just the weaknesses or the risks. Here's a success strategy. Identify and eliminate or outweigh. Ask your prospect, what's the risk? And then ask, what's the reward? If the risk is low and the reward is high, then the decision is obvious. The aspect of risk is a subtle one. Only the best of salespeople will get this concept and harness it. If you don't, there's a bigger risk. The risk that the competition is kicking your butt. Replace risk with a powerful closing tool, risk removal. You're closing in on the purchase. You feel like you've qualified the prospect. You know you're nearly there. Great presentation if you don't say so yourself. But something is still missing. There's a hesitancy, and you can't quite define it. Well, let me help you. The prospect feels the risk of purchase outweighs the reward of ownership. You start to hear the usual stalls like, I'll think about it, call me back later. The kiss of death to a teetering transaction. Or the ever popular, I have to talk this over with, oh, rats. Please note, if the risk is price, then the compensation is value. So, what do? Keep selling? Well, not exactly. The simple answer is, just find out where the risk is and remove it. What is in the way of yes? What risk element is present that I can remove to close this deal? Here's a few inner voice or unstated risk fears that might be in the way of yes. I can't really afford this. I may not be able to make the payments. I'll buy it, get it home, and it won't work. I'll buy it, get it home, and it will look awful. I'll buy it, the boss will see my decision and explode. I'll buy it, then find out if I'd looked around, I could have bought it for less. I'll buy it and never use it. I'll buy it, and then some newer, better model will come along in 2 weeks and I'll be stuck with a piece of history. I'll buy it, and our employees won't like it. I'll buy it, and I'll be out all this money when I could have done without it in the first place. I'll buy it, and it will go on sale next week. Get the drift? Risk factors are usually both invisible and unspoken because they expose the inner guts, feelings, and thoughts of the customers. Here's a remedy. You can bring up a few areas of suspicion in the effort to ameliorate and address the fear. But sometimes it takes floating a few risk removers to discover what the risk barrier might be. Here's a few examples. If you're concerned about whether or not it'll work after you get home, don't worry. You can always bring it back and add some peace of mind. We want you to be happy. We sell lots of companies like yours. But for any reason, your company doesn't like it, we offer a full refund or replacement. We're so sure about our competitive pricing on this item that we'll match any advertised or quoted price that you might discover for up to 45 days after you take delivery. Risk is real and a real block to the sale. And too often, salespeople misjudge risk for objection and continue to press for the close. Ever had a pushy salesman who seemed more interested in your wallet than your safety? Risks are inner emotions that are judged and justified logically in the mind of the prospective purchaser. There's no one remedy. So, here's what to do. Identify your risks. Create great corresponding risk removers or even preventers. Try them out on prospects who resist for no stated reason. Master them. So your prospects buy more often, and once they work, teach them to everyone. I've saved the best for last. There's one technique that can work to both find the risk and close the deal, but it's a delicate one that requires mastery through preparation and practice. The strategy, as I've kind of alluded to earlier, is called what's the risk, what's the reward. When a prospect hesitates, you simply ask him or her to list the risks of purchase. Actually write them down. Prompt others. If the prospect says, I'm not sure, can you ask, could it be? After you feel the list is complete, ask the prospect to list the rewards. Write them down and embellish them as much as you can without puking on the prospect. Then eliminate the risks one by one with lead-in phrases like, suppose we could. Did you know that? I think we can. Then you simply ask, can you see any other reasons not to proceed? One at a time, brick by brick, remove the risks that the buyer perceives as fatal mistakes in his or her decision-making process. Then drive home the rewards, both emotionally and logically. If a customer is qualified, has a stated need, wants it, and it has become risk-free, then you have the reward, the order. Here comes a free red bit. You want to know three risk alarms, three ways to determine that risk may be the reason for non-purchase? Sure you do. Go to Gittimer.com. Register if you're a first-time user and enter the word risk in the red bit box. Red bite. The biggest barrier to a sale is the unspoken risk that a prospect perceives. Every time you say a word or take an action in the selling process, the prospect passes a judgment on you and your product or your service. Should I buy or should I pass? Do I like this guy? Do I trust this guy? Do I believe this guy? The prospect is weighing several factors, but the primary one is, what is the risk of buying versus what is the reward of ownership? The secondary factor is, what's the need versus what's the value? If the reward is high and the risk is low, if the need is high and the value is high, then the order is almost certain. The problem is that the buyer keeps this information to himself, his whole cards if you play poker, and he's not going to show them unless you call. You put in your chips to see his cards. Once these factors are uncovered, once he shows his cards, he's revealed his motive to buy, the single strongest piece of sales information that you could obtain. It's also the single hardest information to obtain. Red bite. If you eliminate risk, they will buy. If you don't eliminate risk, they will not buy, and you will not know why. So you have to ask the prospect just like you asked for the sale. What's the risk versus what's the reward? The secondary question to ask is, what's the need versus what's the value, the difference and the power? In these questions is when you ask about risk or reward and need or value, you'll get better, more intelligent, more honest answers. They're higher level sales questions. They command respect and will breed a higher level of mutual understanding. And those answers will lead you to truth and the sale. Red bite. No risk, no balls. No risk, no reward is a cliche. You've heard it a million times, and it's wrong. I say no risk, no nothing. Any salesperson who's unwilling to risk should get out of sales. Not just a risk in asking for the sale, risk in prospecting, risk in cold calling, risk in fighting the competition, risk in creative follow-ups, and risk in sticking to your price and calling the prospect's bluff. Risk, or the risk factor in selling, permeates every aspect of the process. And people who are unwilling to take risk usually lose to those who do. I call them sales balls. And most salespeople, men and women, don't have them. Later this year, I'm going to be coming out with a line of sales balls. They're going to come in a package of two, of course. And they'll be complete with instructions on how to use them. Until then, take more chances than you dare. You'll make more sales than you expect. That's the formula. Principle 11. When you say it about yourself, it's bragging. When someone else says it about you, it's proof. In this principle, you're going to learn who will testify on your behalf and take your customer with you on your next sales call. The red bites are, who's better at selling your product, you or your customer's testimonial? And testimonials are the only proof you've got. And the most powerful person on your sales team is your customer. Testimonial power, secret. Who will testify on your behalf? Your customers. Testimonials, the single most powerful method of making a sale. Also, the single most wasted resource in creating a marketing message. Every time I see a testimonial, I read it with interest for two reasons. The first, of course, to see what it says. And the second is to determine if it impacts my buying decision. Does it spur me to action? Or does it just get that so what feeling? Testimonials can sell when salespeople cannot. One of the late, great John Patterson's principles of selling was, advertising brings awareness, testimonial advertising brings customers. What he meant was an ad will brand you, but a testimonial ad can create action toward you. When you say something about yourself, it's bragging. When other people say it about you, it's proof. That is the essence of the testimonial. Take a moment before you go any further and look at the written testimonials that you're using. Would they make you pick up the phone and purchase? Or do they say the same old tired, these are wonderful people to do business with. I've been doing business with them for 10 years. That's a passive statement that sounds nice, but it doesn't really have any buy power. Let me give you an example. The great Ty Boyd founded one of the finest speaking skills and presentation schools in the world, right here in Charlotte, North Carolina. It's called the Excellence in Speaking Institute. Thousands of people attend each year, and they love it. Ty wants to use a testimonial campaign. One of his students said, wow, what a tremendous experience, way beyond my expectations. You and ESI are the best. Way too general. To be more effective, testimonials need to have a specific message. General messages have a little act now impact. Here's some good examples. I overcame my fear of speaking. I improved my skills 300% in 3 days. When I first saw myself on video, I wasn't that good. Okay, I was horrible. Now, I'm 1,000% better. Incredible program, incredible results. Now, I can give speeches and lead meetings. My people actually listen to me now. Improving my speaking skills helped me upgrade my leadership skills to a new level. My speaking skills are 100% improved. My self-confidence level is 1,000% improved. The butterflies have been replaced with skills for a lifetime. And don't let price get in the way of your success. I invested in it, and it paid. Now, here's a note. Using a person's name in a testimonial is not important unless it's a celebrity. A big company name is effective. No name is needed unless it's the CEO. What should a written testimonial say? A written testimonial should be phrased in a way that takes away the risk or neutralizes a fear. It should be phrased in a way that shows a value benefit or a specific enhancement. A testimonial should show action and make a call to action. I used to use a competitor. I switched to ABC, and so should you. A testimonial should overcome an objection. I thought their price was too high, bought it anyway, came to realize they had the best value. A testimonial should reinforce a claim. I increased my productivity, I earned more profit. A testimonial should claim a happy ending, ease of use, speed of service. Now my people love to use the copier. And then there's the unspoken secret of testimonials. How do you get them? The answer is the same as it is for referrals. You earn them. The difference with a testimonial is often you will have to earn them and ask for them. It's even okay to prompt the customer as to what to say or what you want them to say if what you want them to say is the truth. The only thing worse than an exaggerated testimonial is the prospect who bought from you and found out the testimonial was exaggerated. I can make you one promise about testimonials, one ironclad guarantee. They work. I can also issue you this caution. They must be used in the proper manner or they lose their power. Oftentimes, salespeople use testimonials to get in the door. Obviously, if that's your only way in, then do it. But the power of testimonial is the proof that they offer at the time the customer is ready to decide. Testimonials should be used at the end of the sales cycle to dispel any doubt, reduce all risk, substantiate value, and pave the way to the order. Act now. List the 10 customers who love you the most. Call them now. Tell them what you need and figure out a way to meet them for breakfast or lunch so you can provide them some kind of value, an idea, a lead. And then at the same time, earn your testimonial prize. If you feel in any way awkward about asking your customer for this favor, I challenge you that your relationship with them is weak. So weak that your competition could earn the business. Testimonials are power and proof that you are what you say you are. Lack of testimonials is weakness and proof that you aren't what you say you are. Let me give you the free red bit. If you want the 4.5 best ways to earn a testimonial, go to Gittimer.com. Register if you're a first-time user and enter the word testimonial in the Gitbit box. Take your best customer with you on your next sales call. Who's the most powerful member of your sales team? A customer. They can outsell, outbrag, and outprove anyone in your company, including the CEO. Why? They're your testimonial. They're your living proof that your product or your service is the best. Want to take your best customer with you on a sales call? Well, if you videotape their loyalty, their reasons, you can. Sound too simple to be true? Well, there's a small hitch. It has to be a quality video, one that reflects your image, one that tells your story in a scripted and meaningful way, a video with direction and style. We bring our prospects and customers to the awareness of the underlying theme and objective of using a video as part of a sales presentation. What do you want to happen when the video is removed from the VCR or the laptop computer? Challenges the salesperson. The answer to that question is the little known secret of a successful video. Too many businesses don't know the elements of a successful video, or they make videos for the wrong reasons. Video will lead you to a sale, but it won't make the sale. That's the job of the salesperson. There's got to be a smooth transition from the end of the video to the next step in the sales cycle. Success comes by making videos on purpose, for a purpose, to achieve a predetermined objective. You've heard the expression, it's the next best thing to being there. Well, a sales video may be the best thing to being there. Here's why. Videos don't forget. Videos never have a bad day, and videos always ask for the sale if you tell them to. But the video is the message. The salesperson is the messenger. Both must be present for maximum results. Selected production tips for making your video dynamic. High quality is worth it. Spend the money. Make it right. Video is what you put into it. You can create any message you want. Less is more. 5 to 8 minutes, optimum runtime. Before you begin yours, watch other people's, several of them. Get ideas of what you want and what you don't want. Make your video real. Be relaxed, animated. Pre-select which parts or sales segments you want to include and write a script before you start. And the biggest secret, what is said about you is 10,000 times more powerful than you saying it. Let your loyal customers tell as much of your story as you can. Here's another expression that you've heard. A picture is worth 1,000 words. Here's the 21st century of that expression. A video picture is worth a sale. What's a video worth? Ask yourself these 4 questions, and the answer becomes self-evident. 1. How much is your image worth? 2. What's one new customer worth? 3. What's a consistent sales message worth? 4. How much is a trained sales force worth. I hear companies having budget fights about whether they should have a video sales tool or not. What a joke. A bunch of non-salespeople trying to dictate the future of the company and omitting a vital tool that will carry them to success. It's like saying, hey, let's buy that big boat over there, but let's not get the engine. It costs too much. Hello. If a video is not in the budget, gag or fire the bean counters, cut your own pay, and go into debt for it. It's that valuable. Take your best customer with you on your next sales call. Take them on video. Now, here's my own personal note. I made my first sales video 2 years ago. It cost me more money than I had. Over the last 24 months, it's helped me make more sales than I could count. This year, I'm making a new one, spending 4 times more than I spent on the first one that I couldn't afford. And thanks to my first video this year, I can afford it. RedByte, who is better at selling your product, you or your customer's testimonial? Not even close. Your customer can outsell you 100-1. And even though you intuitively know this, you still think you have to sell and educate the prospect. Come on, man. Nothing could be more powerful than the words of one customer who loves you telling a customer thinking about doing business with you to do it. Are you going to believe your next-door neighbor who just bought a car like the one you want, or a car salesman? Neighbor, of course. Same with your business, baby. RedByte. Testimonials are the only proof you've got. My testimonial mantra for years has been, when you say it about yourself, it's bragging. When somebody else says it about you, it's proof. Now, knowing this, you would think every sales organization and salesperson would use testimonials as the backbone of their sales message. And you would be wrong. The single most perplexing aspect of selling I have ever seen. RedByte. The most powerful person on your sales team is your customer. Knowing that, why don't you take your customer with you on sales calls? They're better than you at closing the sale. Way better. Your customer, your cat, and your kids sell better than you. You're the worst salesperson on your team. RedByte. Testimonial power secret. Most salespeople are so hell-bent to get a testimonial that they get the wrong kind. And they fail to capture the most important element of the sale, buying motives. Asking a customer to tell you their reasons for purchasing from you will get you hundreds more sales of the same type. Buying motives are 1,000 times more powerful than selling skills. Make that 10,000. Oh, make that 1,000,000. What are your customers saying about you?
Principle 12, antennas up. Here's what you're going to learn in this principle. Using your sixth sense, the sense of selling. And the RedByte's are, what's your focus factor? Antennas up at all times. The awareness factor that's always around. The men's room at LaGuardia Airport and flying to Dallas. Here we go. Using your sixth sense, the sense of selling. Come to your senses.